welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Crickets and bees. These are hot topics that contributed to the buzz and chirp among researchers who attended a recent meeting of the Canadian Zoological Society at the University of Lethbridge. And technological change. Peter Carr of the Center of Innovative Management at Athabasca University releases the results of yet another study on supply chain management. One of the disturbing findings is that managers who think they're ready to handle what the future has in store are merely fooling themselves. All this in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. To the untrained ear, the sound of crickets is soothing, an auditory reminder that nature still abounds somewhere, out there beyond the hubbub of urban life. But don't fool yourself. When those crickets call, there's something evil lurking in the grass. Just ask Sean Walker. He's a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Lethbridge, and he presented some of his findings to a gathering of parasitologists at a recent meeting of the Canadian Zoological Society in Lethbridge.
Well, it's sort of interesting because male crickets will call to attract mates, or they'll sit and be fairly silent and wait to sort of intercept females on their way as they're moving through the environment. And these calling males are subject to parasitism by a very small fly that homes in on them based on their calling song. So it basically hears them and flies right to them and then parasitizes them.
What kind of a fly is that? What's it called?
It's a tachinid fly. The scientific name is Ormia ochrocea.
What are some of the things that you're looking at?
We're working on several different things. What I'm working on right now is looking at these two different strategies that males use, either being silent or calling, and how the presence or absence of this fly influences the number of females that these males encounter. Because if you think about a calling male, gets parasitized by the fly, dies relatively quickly thereafter, but these silent males don't attract as many females as the calling males do. But over their lifetimes, what can happen is these satellite males, by not getting parasitized and living a long time, can meet with a relatively large number of females. So sort of an interesting situation where natural selection, or these flies, sort of opposes sexual selection. So they want to call because it attracts females, but it also attracts these flies that kill them.
What are the flies like? They must be pretty tiny.
Yeah, they are. They're, how large are they? I think 6 or 7 millimeters or so.
So how do they actually go about parasitizing the crickets?
They'll land on the ground nearby the cricket, and then they larviposit. So they'll lay a live larvae, and that larvae crawls up on the cricket and then burrows into him, and then proceeds to eat him from the inside. Yeah.
Sounds like the alien.
Yeah, that's about right.
When you look at this, then, how does this fit into the bigger scheme of things? How can you use the results from your research?
One of the things that is sort of interesting are all the different ways animals have evolved to sort of attract mates. And so you look at peacocks, and they have very large tails and things like that. And so there are different costs associated with having these very large, elaborate signals and things like that. And especially in lots of invertebrates, there are other animals that seem to co-opt these signals that the animals are using and use them for their own purposes. So in this case, we've got male crickets that call, and then this small fly that has sort of figured out the signal is with this cricket, and so the fly comes in, parasitizes the cricket based on what it uses to attract mates.
Do crickets have different kinds of calls?
Yeah. They have three different kinds of calls. Males will exhibit the regular calling song, which is what most people hear when you're walking around outside in the evening or whatever and you hear the crickets calling. And then there's also a separate song that's a courtship song, that's a very quiet song that they sing when they're in proximity with a female and they're trying to convince her to mate with them. And then there's a third type of song that male crickets use when there are aggressive encounters between males. So when they run into each other, they'll have a pretty sharp, sort of loud chirp, and then they'll fight, but that's the three songs, I guess. So.
Now, how do you actually go about doing this? Do you have to run around at night and collect crickets?
We do for some things. What we've been doing now is mainly work in the lab. So we have large numbers of crickets that we've reared in the lab, and then we can record their songs under different conditions, or put them, you know, in the same container with a female and record the courtship songs or whatever. The flies, all the work we do with the flies is done out in the field because it's fairly difficult to rear them in the laboratory and require lots of crickets. You know, I have to feed them all our crickets and we wouldn't have any, so...
At what stage are you with your research now? Are you finished it, or do you have to do some more stuff?
We're sort of in the middle of a lot of it. The stuff with alternative male strategies, so males that are silent and versus males that are calling, we've finished sort of the modeling aspects of it, and then we'll go out into the field and do some other experiments with the crickets. And there are several other projects that we're going to go work on this summer out in southern Texas and across the southeast United States in terms of looking at what types of song this fly prefers to come into. So it actually, this fly parasitizes several different species of crickets across the range of the fly. And so what we're going to do is go play different songs in different places and see what the fly's like and what the cricket's like and how those sort of things have co-evolved.
Now, with this conference, what are you getting out of this conference?
Oh, it's neat to see all the different research and what different people are doing. For me, it's been great to interact with a bunch of Canadian zoologists. I'm originally from the States, so this is the first time I've ever been at a Canadian Society of Zoologists meeting. And it's a lot of fun, and everybody's great. And it's neat. Probably the best thing about conferences is the chance to interact with people that you wouldn't normally interact with. And they may have, you know, ideas for your research that are good, and you can share ideas with them. And it's just a great time to interact with people and have a good time.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Sean Walker, a biologist and postdoctoral fellow at the University of Lethbridge. Bees, bees, and more bees. Bees were a hot topic of discussion at the Zoological Conference in Lethbridge. Among the many researchers who are studying bees is Ralph Carter. He's an associate professor at the University of Lethbridge.
They're naturally nice study organisms because they occur in large numbers throughout the northern hemisphere in particular, but I mean, they're worldwide, but Canada and has lots of bumblebees, and no matter almost anywhere you go, you will find bumblebees. And they're large and cute, so people notice them. I mean, you find bumblebees described in literature and poetry and that sort of thing, and they're part of our common experience. People relate to them nicely. And because bumblebees are so common, they're also important pollinators. So not just in agricultural systems where bumblebees are far better pollinators than many of the other bees we use as pollinators, like honeybees or leafcutter bees or those sorts of bees. And in the natural environment, bumblebees are one of the most important pollinators around. Partly because they're very hairy, so they're very good. Those hairs trap pollen on the bees' bodies, and the plant obviously wants to use the bee as an agent for moving pollen, and bees do that very effectively.
Now, you've given your presentation at the conference on the effect of logging on bumblebees and flowers, and what's happening there?
This is part of a larger study called EMEND, which the acronym stands for Ecosystem Management Emulating Natural Disturbances. The idea of this project is to try to help forest companies log in ways that mimic natural disturbances. And so we can try to find out what are the differences between logging and burning and other things and control sites where no logging is happening. And my shtick in that is to study the bumblebees and the plants that those bumblebees visit.
What are some of the things that you're actually looking at? What do? Do you go crawling around the cut blocks looking for dead bees?
Not dead bees, but it's really the people who are helping me in this project, Brent Magnan and Richard Ehlert, sensed bumblebees and their plants. So they walked up and down through these various treatments and counted how many bees they encountered and what flowers they encountered that we know the bees go visit. And from this information, we found preliminary results intermediate levels of logging are actually not too harmful on the bees. The numbers of bees are greater in areas where roughly 25 to 50% of the canopy trees have been removed by logging compared to clear cuts or compared to natural situations. And the same is true of the plants that they visit. The greatest number of flowers are available for bees in places of intermediate levels of logging, say between 25 and 50% of the crown trees removed.
Is that because there's more sunlight and then there's more flowers that come up?
Exactly. I'm just speculating about that, but it would seem reasonable that if you have more sunlight coming in, the plants can photosynthesize better, can produce more flowers. But the extreme would be a clear cut, right, and where you don't necessarily get more bee habitat produced because you're changing the environment in a much stronger way. You're baking the environment, and that they've had problems with reforestation and large clear cuts, largely because of microclimate change, essentially, where it's very hard to be a seedling coming up in a large expanse that, with huge temperature fluctuations and a lot of evaporation, water not staying around. But anyway, to get back to those two points, so intermediate logging, levels of logging produce more bees and more plants that the bees like. But perhaps the most intriguing part of we've been finding is that when you look at the mapping of bees onto plants, so you're looking at what is the relationship between changes in plant density and changes in bee density, and how do those relate to each other? Logging changes that relationship. So it's not just a case of them of getting more bees and more bee plants. It's shifting the way that bees track the bee plants. So the shift is in a particular direction. What you end up finding is that the best places for plants, so those compartments that were logged that produced the best plants, ended up having far more bees there than should have been there. And the places that were logged that produced fewer plants had too few bees there. So essentially what you're seeing is an over-concentration of bees in the best places and an under-concentration of bees in the worst places. So the bees that are in those best places aren't necessarily doing very well.
How significant is that? Is this something that you can draw conclusions that would help in the way you might manage the forest or the type of logging that should or shouldn't be done?
This is hard to say because at this point we still need more work to come to firm conclusions about this. But one speculation would be that an impact of logging is to change this distribution of bees on plants. So you might find that in fact logging, that bees in natural areas near logged areas end up being drawn into those logged areas because of the greater numbers of plants, and you get too many bees showing up in those places, and what you end up happening is poor pollinator service in natural areas that happen to be adjacent to logged areas but aren't logged themselves. So you might think here's this pristine environment that hasn't been touched by logging, when in fact if it's within a bee flight of some logged area, you might find that the plants there are not doing very well and the bees there are not doing very well because they're traveling all this distance to places at which they don't do that well. And this is entirely speculative, but that is one prediction that might be the case if this holds up, if this relationship between logging and the bee plant match is in fact a general one, and so how would that change the forest company's behavior? Perhaps one thing to think about, I guess, is that you may want to concentrate logging in areas far from protected areas. So we see a lot of development pressure for development right up to the edges of national parks. For example, the development at Waterton National Park, where they're trying to put in a subdivision. We see the Cheviot Mine trying to go in right next to Jasper Park, and this kind of thing happens all over Alberta and all over Canada. This kind of result that I'm finding suggests that, in fact, we do need these buffer zones. If we want to keep natural areas pristine, we can't. We have to protect areas near those natural areas too. So one take-home message might be concentrate your logging, if you're going to do it at all, concentrate it in places far from protected areas.
When you talk about bees, are there a lot of different kinds of bees or different species of bees?
There are, yeah. Generally we just see them as all cute, furry bumblebees, but in fact at the Imen site there are at least 10 species of bees that are relatively common. At any one place you go, there are up to 4 or 5 common species of bees, and they differ in their ecologically. The important difference is their tongue length. The bees of short tongues can only probe short corolled flowers, or they cheat by biting holes in the back of a long corolled flower and enter from behind, not even providing the plant with pollinator service. Whereas long-tongued bees can visit a whole range of flowers, but they're most efficient on very deep corolled flowers. Deep corolla being the flower tube, essentially.
More like a lily.
Yeah, that would be an example of a deep corolled flower, right? And they also differ in their. And how we tell the different species most easily is just by looking at the color of their pile, their fur, essentially. The colors on their abdomens is and their head and their thorax, the three different parts of the bodies, differ. So you sometimes have black in places, sometimes orange, sometimes yellow, and it's just, you know, the pattern of banding is very different. And so I can foresee one day when bee watching might be as common as bird watching, because, you know, in a sense, you can tell the different species relatively easily just by seeing where the colors, what the color is and where that color exists.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Ralph Carter, an associate professor in biological sciences at the University of Lethbridge. The world economy is becoming more interconnected and computerized, and individual businesses are gradually integrating digital technology into their systems, albeit some are handling the change better than others. As part of its ongoing research on supply chain management, Athabasca University is looking at how businesses are adapting to the information age and where the gaps lie. Peter Carr is the director of the Center of Innovative Management at Athabasca University.
The latest study we've done is focusing on collaboration inside the supply chain. So we're seeing technology now enable information to be shared more easily between organizations, and we know that's going to happen an awful lot more in the future. So we wanted to understand where that was in Canadian business and what the issues might be for organizations and the economy more widely as this technology is introduced.
How have you gone about doing this study?
We worked with the Purchasing Managers Association of Canada. They supplied us with their email list, which was about 5,000 purchasing managers and professionals in Canada. And then we added to that with a group of general managers and IT specialists to give us what we thought was a very good survey base that would allow us to see it from a technology perspective, from a traditional supply chain purchasing manager perspective, and then also from a general management perspective. So we thought we had the three views that would allow us to understand what was happening with technology in the supply chain.
What are the main areas that you were getting at? What were you asking in that study?
We were trying to understand the extent to which collaboration was taking place now within the supply chain, the extent to which the technologies that allow information to be shared were actually being used and how that was affecting organizations. And we were looking at that in contrast to what we had seen in the past with technology in the supply chain, which was a focus more on competition with the creation of market spaces, online auctions, and that sort of thing. And what we found was really quite surprising. We found that 78% of the people who responded to our survey, altogether about 1,100 people, were telling us that they wanted to use technology more in their relationships with their customers and suppliers, and that they believed that this would contribute very strongly to their business. So we saw from that a very widespread view that collaborative technologies were going to be used more in the future.
Now, what do you mean by collaborative technologies or even collaboration? Because when you think of business, you think of competition.
Sure. And I think that there really are those two different views of how companies work with each other. What we mean by collaboration is customers and suppliers working better together to enable their businesses to perform better. And there are all sorts of areas that can happen in. It can happen in product design, where you're working with the people who are going to be contributing to the construction of a project or a product, and using their expertise to enable the design to be a better one. You're also looking at coordination around inventory levels to be able, enable you to operate at lower cost levels with lower stock because you're coordinating better how that's applied. You may be looking at it at delivery costs and transport organization to work better together to improve these things. So there are all sorts of areas that collaboration can benefit organizations, and the technology now is making that easier because it allows people to see what each other's companies are doing and then to work more effectively together to address the things that they can both see. And in the past, that relied on companies being physically near each other. The movement towards this, I think, really started in Japan since the Second World War, where companies would be located very closely together. But now, with technology, distance becomes much less a factor. And of course, that's especially important here in Canada.
But this requires the use or the integration of innovative technologies. Not everybody is up to speed or is working at the same level. How do you deal with that?
Absolutely. And the position that these technologies are at today, we're seeing integration within organizations has proceeded to quite a high level. That's something that's not too difficult for most companies to now achieve. But for the technologies to be integrated from one business to another, it can happen on a limited level, but we're a long way from where that's likely to be. It's more expensive just now, and there are a lot of technical issues related to it. So what we're likely to see over the next few years is that those technologies become more affordable. The difficulty just now is that we're seeing that while we have 78% of those who responded who wanted to do more with their customers and suppliers this way, 54% believed that they were limited in what they could do by the pace of development of those customers and suppliers. So we've seen a huge pent-up demand, and what we might call a sign that a revolution in how companies work together is likely to come in the future once those barriers, costs, and things like that are removed. However, what we also saw was that 29% of those who responded to our survey said that they didn't think they'd be able to afford the technologies they needed to keep up. And so there's a serious question here about the impact that the increasing use of collaborative technologies, expensive as they are now, will have on smaller companies and on other organizations that can't afford them. These technologies are going to have a direct impact on companies' competitive positions. And this is something that I think we need to do a lot more thinking about. Certainly, if small organizations are going to be at a greater disadvantage because of these technologies, then that's something we might want to address from a policy point of view.
Are there any suggestions at this point as to how those concerns might be addressed?
I think there are really two avenues towards it. One is that the technologies themselves are likely to become more affordable, and so the technical development, if you like, may well help this to be overcome. But also, I think there is a question here about the role that government might play to provide common environments that might be used by small organizations that they could take advantage of to enable them to participate more effectively in supply chains. But at the end of the day, I think it's something that companies themselves that are keen to establish these relationships, the larger organizations, which our study tells us are more dominant now inside supply chains and increasingly so, are going to need to take an approach to those relationships that says it's valuable for us to have these relationships with these smaller organizations. That's something that's good for us, and therefore we have a responsibility too to help that change to happen.
If some companies are going to have trouble keeping up with the technology, what also then does that mean for their ability to keep up the skills of their workers?
One of the most surprising things we found inside our survey was that only 32% of those who responded to it thought that their skills would need to be upgraded in the future. That's 32% of the supply chain managers who responded to it. And for us, that's very serious, because the world that we can see emerging now is one that's very different in terms of the role that particularly purchasing people play inside organizations today. So it really, I think, the survey sends an alarm bell to say, you know, this is a situation that needs to be changed, that companies need and their employees need to address very carefully, because these jobs are going to change dramatically. And at the moment, people don't really understand that change is coming.
So they don't see that they'll need to upgrade or to change, so they just haven't seen the future yet.
Yes, that's absolutely right. The scale of the change just isn't being anticipated, and the danger is that people are going to, people's lives will become very difficult if they're not ready for the changes that are going to come.
How do you overcome that?
I think training is certainly one of the ways to do it, and the work that we're doing here in our school is around creation of this simulation model of the future, which will enable people to come in and play a role inside a fictitious or simulated organization and better understand the new roles that will be required and the new activities that will be required to enable this type of supply chain work to take place.
You've released the results of this survey in Ottawa to a group of people there. Why Ottawa?
I think because this is a national question, and it's something that's going to affect the country as a whole. And the message really that we are seeking to communicate is that collaboration is a very good thing. It's a great thing for Canadian organizations, and as a country we need to look at it seriously. But there's also this question of what happens with smaller organizations. And, you know, for us, I guess, what better place than Ottawa to make that, to release those results, to make sure that the politicians hear the results and hopefully act on them.
One study always leads to another, so what's next?
I think our focus now is in how to make collaboration take place effectively, because what our study really says is that this is a key component in how organizations compete effectively now. And we think that's really a very, very early stage. It's going to involve the use of new communications technologies and also issues around companies sharing information with each other across the supply chain. And we're very much focused on that. We have a huge research project that we're involved in creating a simulation environment that will reflect this new world and will allow us to study people's behavior within it and hopefully help people do it better in the future.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Peter Carr, Director of the Center of Innovative Management at Athabasca University. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. You can listen to past programs on our new website at innovationalberta.com. The program is sponsored by the University of Lethbridge, the Alberta Research Council, the Alberta Conservation Association, Health Sciences Association of Alberta, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, True North Energy, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, and the Sustainable Forest Management Network. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.